Han var tjeckisk-tysk fabriksägare. Han utgav sig för att vara nazist. Och ändå så räddade han något mer än 1000 judar från att bli dödade i Hitlers gaskammare. Hur vågade judar lita på honom? Och vem var han egentligen, verklighetens Oskar Schindler?
First he was a saint. Afterwards he was an alcoholic, a drunker, a woman chaser, a very handsome man, charming man, and I don't think so I could resist him if he would make advances to me, but he saved us. In first place, he was our saver.
He was a flamboyant bon vivant, a black marketeer and a gambler, a drinker and womanizer. To the Germans, he was a loyal agent for military intelligence. He was also Oskar Schindler, the man who stole Jews from the Nazis. Under Adolf Hitler, he schemed and prospered and became a very rich man indeed. In Czechoslovakia and Poland, he served Hitler's army as a spy. His munitions factory provided for the Nazi war effort. But Oskar Schindler, by building his own concentration camp and at great risk to himself, was the only German in the history of the war to save more than 1,000 Jews from the ovens of the death camps. This is the true story of the enigma that was Oskar Schindler. September the 1st, 1939, and Adolf Hitler tells an enthusiastic German Reichstag that Germany is to invade Poland. The night before, in a series of faked provocative incidents, a German border radio station had apparently been overrun by Polish soldiers. In reality, these invaders were German soldiers dressed in Polish uniforms, provided by an agent of the German Abwehr. Oskar Schindler. A week later, the triumphant Germans paraded through the Polish city of Krakow and declared it the capital of their conquered eastern territories. Krakow, with one of the most established Jewish communities in Europe, quickly feels the impact of the new rulers. Synagogues where people have worshipped since the 14th century are closed down, except for propaganda filming purposes. A series of laws are enacted affecting the whole population, but with especially harsh regulations for Jews. Every aspect of life is to be controlled. Jews are expelled from their homes, herded, rounded up with no rights. Arbitrary, instant retribution.
I remember being very, very unhappy the first few weeks. It came about the Jewish holidays, and I remember, like today, standing with my mother in a little synagogue and crying, and they were all strange people around us. But little by little, they reduce us to nothing. So,
how did they do that?
Very systematically, they were coming with all sorts of gimmicks. They, first of all, had what we would call an action. Ever so often, they reduced the amount of people living in ghetto simply by selecting this one will stay and this one will go.
My father and mother
the youngest sister and the youngest brother. The Germans put them on an area in the middle of the town, and they asked the men to go to one side and the women and children on the other side. People knew that the men will go to a camp to work. And my father had decided that he will not leave my mother, my brother and a sister. He went over on the other side, and my mother was holding a child in her hand, and my father was holding a child in her hand, and they shot him on the spot. I know it for a fact, because a few days later, people who knew my father and mother came to the camp, and they told me the story. They were crying. They felt that they had neglected, and they felt that my father was like the last defiance, like a hero. And that's the insanity of it, that we, the innocent, felt guilty what the murderers did to us.
Under the German master plan, one day Krakow, Poland, Europe would be completely Jew-free. Until then, Jewish slave labor could be exploited. Jews without work permits would be rounded up. Work at least offered the chance of life.
Walking on one of the streets, I was suddenly stopped by a few SS people that jumped out of a truck and rounded up people. And before we know, we were on the road on to someplace. We didn't know exactly where we were going, but we did wind up in what was later on known to us as the Marienwerke. And at that time, Schindler appeared where the SS guards lined us up for his inspection. He looked at us and he selected me out of the group, picked me out, and he declared to the SS guards that he doesn't want any children. He said in German, "Ich brauche keine Kinder hier." The SS guards replied very quickly that when we bring you people, you keep them, and that they parted with him, and he kept the all of us that they delivered.
The Deutsche Emal Warenfabrik of Oskar Schindler, Emalia to its Jewish workers, a bankrupt business producing enamel kitchenware, obtained in December 1939, in the first instance, as a cover for his intelligence gathering work. Nothing in the background of the 31-year-old Schindler obviously prepared him for any sort of heroic role. He came from the small industrial town of Zwietau in the Sudetenland region of Czechoslovakia. He was raised a strict Catholic, although there were Jews in his class at school, and his next-door neighbor was a Jewish rabbi with two sons. Young Oscar was an outgoing, non-academic boy who even then enjoyed being the center of attention. As a teenager, he developed a passion for fast cars and motorcycles in which his father indulged him. And then in 1928, he married Emily, a religious girl from a neighboring village. A small-time salesman during the 30s, he then became a Nazi spy. The Czechs arrested him in August 1938, but he was released after Hitler annexed the Sudetenland. Now, as a member of the National Socialists, he was again free to continue life as the Playboy secret agent.
Er war ein Mann, der das Leben geliebt hat, ein großer Lebemann. Das muss ich sagen. Die Frauen haben ihm alle gefallen. Gegen eine Frau können sie ankämpfen, aber nicht gegen 10 oder 100 Frauen. Also soll das schwimmen und rennen, ne? Stimmt das? Also mich hat das überhaupt nicht gestört. Sie können einen Menschen nicht ändern, wenn er so ist. Das ist bloßer Unsinn, wenn sie mit einem Menschen streiten. Oder wer weiß ich was. Ich habe mit niemandem gestritten. Why? Er liebte die Frauen, er liebte die Gesellschaft, er liebte, was soll ich sagen, manchmal, dass die anderen die Arbeit getan haben. Das hat ihm sehr gut getan, wenn die anderen haben gearbeitet und er hat nichts gemacht.
He was very vain, as we can put it. He liked to put, for example, plenty of perfume on himself. When he went to Monopoly, this was in Krakow, Part of government agency for the monopoly for liquor, for tobacco and everything. So when he went there, so everybody knew Mr. Schindler is here because the whole hall was, this was the smell of his perfume. Oscar, he liked to have attention from everybody. He liked to be the center of the attraction. He was impulsive, but not in a way that something bad or something, but let's do it, let's go. So, example, we went to Berlin and we walk in the streets and there was a big store with cars. So we were looking through the window, there was a beautiful car, light blue, Horch. So he asked me, shall I buy the car? I said, cool. So go ahead, buy the car. I was laughing. He was not kidding. He just went to the other people and so they gave him money and he bought the car.
In occupied Poland, the German businessman with his 17-foot sports car was guaranteed to attract attention. For this was a country of shortages. By trading up to 90% of his factory's output on the black market, Schindler was able to amass a small fortune. But his own black market purchases were also considerable.
The things Schindler bought on the black market were diamonds, fur coats, beautiful Persian carpets, famous artist paintings, anything that has a tremendous value at present or even in future, because only this way he could bribe those people what he needed for his particular purpose.
Schindler's particular purpose was far from clear. Daily his Jews traveled from the ghetto to his factory. Daily they were faced with threats of roundups or worse. When some of his workers were arrested, he obtained their release by bribing the SS. Using information obtained from top officials, he was able to warn his workers about impending roundups. Then, at the end of 1942, the Germans decided to close the ghetto down. On these fields, on the outskirts of the town, on the site of a Jewish cemetery on Jerusalem Street, a forced labor camp was to be built for those Jews still required to work for the Germans. The Jewish mortuary building was blown up. Jewish prisoners were forced to desecrate the graves of their forefathers to make a road through the camp from tombstones. This was to be Plaszow forced labor camp, home for 20,000 Jewish men, women, and children. SS Untersturmführer Armin Goert, fresh from the liquidation of the Lublin ghettos, was brought to Krakow to run the new camp and supervise the destruction of the remains of Krakow Jewish life.
Armin Goert himself, with his SS men, was in charge. Elderly women, children, sick people were shot on the spot, and they were brought up with flat trucks into our camp in Plaszow. I myself, with a group of other boys, had to unload the people who were shot. In one case, we asked a German, because a young kid was there and wasn't dead yet. And we asked her, would you give a Gnade Schuss? A Gnade. Gnade is the word like a kindness. So we will not bury her alive. And he said, throw it in. It's a schade. He said, it's a shame to waste a bullet on that schmutzige Jude. And we had to pour gasoline over them, and we kept on burning them.
Proudly, the German film units showed their action squads at work. But one German sought to protect his people from the orgy of killing.
On the morning of March 13, 1943, Schindler has told us not to return to the ghetto as we would normally do, but to remain there and make the best of it by sleeping wherever we can, because there was trouble in the ghetto. The ghetto was being liquidated, there's killings going on, and he wants to keep us over that period. During that period, while I was in the factory, staying over for the next 3 nights and worked during days or worked nights. The ghetto was liquidated together with my family of parents, two sisters, two brothers. The one brother was shot down as he tried to cross from one line to another one. The rest of the family's fate is unknown to me, but I suspect they went to Auschwitz. I have never seen him since.
More than 2,000 people died in the ghetto during those days. The survivors began a life behind barbed wire.
It was frightening. It was very sad. I think the first time I realized that there is no way out. People were committing suicide right then and there. I remember a doctor's mother that took some poison in the same barrack where I was staying. This was the beginning. Then one day they came and they told us to give everything that we own in way of money and jewelry and things like that. And we had to put it on the pile, and this was the end of it.
From his villa inside the camp perimeter, Commandant Amon Gert did not want for the small luxuries that made life so agreeable for loyal servants of the Third Reich. That summer of 43 was a warm one. Gert had soon installed his German mistress Ruth in the villa with him. What was it like for the 24-year-old German, now, as we see, dying from emphysema, surrounded as she was then by the remnants of Krakow's jury, the old and the young?
I never see any old people, and I never saw any children. I just saw, I remember one afternoon there came a big car, and this car was full of children. They went somewhere, and I had a girlfriend there, the wife of Mr. Scherner, and I said, oh, look at that, they are bringing the children somewhere, and I was down, you see, and it went to my heart somehow. And she had herself two children. Oh, she said, they're Jews.
Cater for his musical interests, Gert appointed his own resident musicians from among the inmates, brothers Hermann and Leo Rosner.
I got full dress, I got tuxedo, I got street suit. So whenever I played by the commandant, I used one of those three, never prisoner's guard. And it depends what kind of party it was, it just called the police, and they told me, Rosner, come down, that's it. Usually after healings, to clear his conscience, most of the time he called us. For not long, but parties he played very long.
Soon a frequent visitor to Gert's parties was businessman Oskar Schindler. He could captivate all with his easy charm. Schindler, with his reputation for sheltering Jews, had become a close friend of Amon Gert, the man who'd supervised the slaughter in the ghetto and one of the most feared Germans in Krakow.
Amon Gert took out 50 boys. I was one among them. And we went out to make a garden. And on the way home, one boy had escaped. And when we came in to the gates, and they started counting us, and they saw there was only 49. They wouldn't let us enter, and they called on Get. Get came down with a few SS, and he was screaming and yelling, "Where's the 50th? And we act that we don't know. We really didn't know. We couldn't say that we saw him escape. So he took every second one, 25 or 24, one to the right of my hand and one to the left, was shooting him on the spot. And he said, "That's what's happening if any one of you ever escape. And we make ourselves almost like a promise that we are responsible for our friends. How can we save one life and put in jeopardy 25 or even maybe more?"
He wasn't a brutal killer. No, not no more than other people, other SS people was it. No more. He didn't, it just for the fun of it, you see. He wasn't a brutal killer. He thought that what all the SS thought about Jews.
And what was that?
If they were there just to work. He didn't kill them just for the fun of it, you see. And it was not a camp where people in Vernichtungslager like Auschwitz.
But there were a lot of bodies that were dug up at Plaszów. Where did they come from?
I don't know. I don't know. He killed some Jews too, natürlich. And such a camp, it's not amusing. It's not amusing, really not. I stayed often in the kitchen with my maids and always said to them, if I could do anything, I would to all of you say, go home. But I can't do anything.
One of those maids was a young Jewish prisoner, Helena Hirsch.
Przede wszystkim był sadystą, ale w postaci pięknego człowieka, to bym nie uwierzyła nigdy, w takim człowieku taki szatan może się zachować. Morderca, żony krwi. Pewnego razu Get, to było rano, wcześniej, rano miał wyjść, woła mnie do siebie. Oczywiście biegiem przyleciał. Wskazuje mi na rękaw, była plama, możliwe otarcie z muru. Możliwe, nie mam pojęcia z jakiego powodu. Było rzeczywiście, ale nieznaczna plama. To ja mówię, słuchaj, ja nie wiem. Poldek to był jego pucy but, który przygotowywał ubranie, but cholewy mu czyścił. Możliwe, że on nie zauważył. Oczywiście na to ja dostałam, zostałam spoliczkowana w taki sposób, że momentalnie ogłuchłam i zaczęło mi dzwonić w uchu niesamowicie. To ja się odzywam do niego, Herr Kommandeur, jemand läutet an der Tür. Na to on mnie szczelił po raz drugi w twarz, że mi prysła krew z ucha. Oczywiście on bez wrażenia to mi gej du as, du hury. Tu widzisz Verbrecherin.
You were living with a man who hated Jews.
He didn't hate them. It's too much.
Let me put it a different way. You yourself have said
that... Do you think Schindler liked Jews? He loves them or no? No. He was... What I said, he was a lovable opportunist. And he needed them, so he worked with them. But he didn't take them on his heart.
To the SS then, a lovable opportunist. But his frequent visits to the camp also gave Schindler easy access to the prisoners. Prisoners like Helena in her basement kitchen.
I razu pewnego przyszedł na... Był w dobrym humorze, może lubiał pić, nie powie, że nie. I objął mnie tak. Pan rozumie, wtedy Niemiec obejmuje Żydówkę, to to było Rassenschande. Ja się strasznie przelękłam. Ja się usuwam od niego. To on mówi, nie bój się. To objęcie moje i nawet ten cał, który ja złożę na twoim czole, to nie jest to, co ty myślisz. To jest ojcowski, przyjacielski pocałunek i chciałbym ci bardzo pomóc. I to tak stale przychodził. Razu pewnego wyszedł ze mną na podwórze i naprzeciwko pracowali ludzie. Zwozili kamienie. Te zwożenie tych kamieni to była taka syzyfowa praca. Skończyli zwozić, to jest z powrotem wysyłali. I tak było. I on tak stoi ze mną, obejmuje mnie. Mam wrażenie, że wtedy getta nie było w kuchni, w ogóle we willi. Mam wrażenie. I powiada, ty znasz te przejścia Żydów, jak pracowali w Egipcie. Tutaj też pracują ci Żydzi. Ale ty też pamiętasz, że ich uratowano z Egiptu. Wyszli cało i zdrowi z Egiptu. Wy też zostaniecie wybawieni z tego piekła. To były jego słowa. Zawsze przychodził z pocieszeniem.
Did you get the sense that Schindler was a good Nazi?
We all were good Nazis in this sense. We couldn't be anything else. We had to believe in all these things. What could we have done? Nothing. We couldn't even do anything against it.
In early 1943, Oskar Schindler developed a most extraordinary plan. On a spare lot in the backyard of his factory, he would build his own concentration camp for 1,000 Jews. Here in wooden barracks, he would house his workers and workers from neighboring factories. By exploiting his friendship with the SS and Commandant Amon Goeth, Jews would be brought from the arbitrary terror of Plaszów to the safety of his factory in Lipowa Street, Emalia.
Of course, the conditions in Emalia were entirely different from Plaszów. And for the first time, we felt safe. We somehow knew that all the things that happened to us, like that 25 lashes and things of that sort, can never happen there. And they didn't. They never did happen. Whenever the Germans came to Emalia, somehow Schindler was able to give the message to us. Let's say somebody was cooking something to remove everything from the stove. And even when Goeth came, the doors and the shutters were closed. And he, from the barracks where the people worked for Schindler were closed when the Germans came. And he explained to them, these are the barracks of my company. And no soldiers, no SS men ever walked into our barracks.
So people are eating, they have bread. It was like to fall on the other planet. Mr. Schindler came to the garage. They told me, the people, now Oskar Schindler is coming. So he greets me, even he gave me his hand. I was afraid to give him a hand, to shake hands. But he told me, don't be afraid. I heard you were a good mechanic, so you will enjoy your staying here. And don't be afraid, you will never be hungry. And so I told him Polish to my friends when he went out. Tell me, he's a bluffer or it is so? So said, no, it is so. It is so.
With the black market and cheap Jewish slave labor, the small-time pre-war salesman had become a successful businessman with a private stable. And in the evenings, rounds of drinks and parties with his military and SS contacts. With charm and diamonds, Schindler bought security for his Jews.
Die Verständigung wurde mehr darauf zurückgeführt, dass man das bezahlen musste. Das wurden mit Brillanten, nicht mit Geld, nein, das waren immer kleine Geschenke von Brillanten und andere Sachen. Aha, das musste gegeben werden. Geld hat keinen Wert. Das mussten Schmuckstücke, das mussten auserlesene Schmuckstücke sein, mit denen man das bezahlte, dass die Menschen dort bleiben. Aber diese Menschen musste mein Mann den SS bezahlen.
But Schindler himself was not above suspicion. He was arrested 3 times by the SS and spent up to a week in the cells. The charges range from the trivial to being involved in major black market fraud, which could carry the death penalty. But every time, his connections in military intelligence and the armaments inspectorate brought about his release.
Aber das war die Rückendeckung von der Abwehr. Und auf der anderen Seite war das der deutsche Rüstungskommando. Und dort war, dass er nämlich die Juden behalten konnte, damit die Juden nicht nach Auschwitz gefahren werden. Das hat die deutsche Rüstungskommando wieder bewerkstelligt. Nur die SS musste bezahlt werden, damit sie nicht zum Schluss aus Böshaftigkeit, aus Boshaftigkeit die Menschen wegnehmen und erschießen.
Schindler, the secret agent on other duties in Turkey. He traveled there in his Horch sports car and after meeting with the German ambassador von Papen, did some sightseeing. And then in 1943, he became a double agent. Budapest, the capital of Hungary, was still comparatively untouched by the war and the Jewish Relief Organization was able to operate there. Schindler traveled from Krakow, smuggled in a baggage van with newspapers, to meet the Jewish agent in Budapest, Samuel Springman. In a grand hotel, Schindler gave Springman details of the fate of Krakow's ghetto and produced as evidence instructions he'd received from Commandant Goert about the rounding up of Jews. He returned to Krakow with aid money for Plaschow's inmates. By the end of 1943, on the Russian front, the Germans were being forced to pull back, and in the West, the Allies landed in Italy. In Krakow, Schindler's factory is celebrating its 4th anniversary. He now not only produces kitchenware, but ammunition for the war effort. With the war closing in on every front, the German extermination machine has speeded up in a frenzied attempt to implement the final solution. From all over Europe, Jews are being herded directly into the ovens of Auschwitz. Then, by mid-1944, with the Russians pushing forward into Poland, the Germans are forced to dismantle their camps near the front. Essential war industries are to be moved to safer territory. The Jewish workers will be disposed of. Schindler's Haven was finally to be broken up.
In August of 1944, Schindler was ordered to reduce the size of the inmates of his camp, of what was approximately 1,000 people, by two-thirds and leave one-third as his workforce. The SS guards helped in that shipment and separation of the 700 people to be shipped to Krakow-Plaszów. As the SS guards were marching in front of the people and making the selection with Schindler's help, I found myself what I thought in the wrong group where I would be shipped out rather than remain in the Emalia works. I at that time ran forward from my line towards Schindler, and I declared to him, "Herr Schindler, kein Tischler ist geblieben," which meant that there was no carpenter left in the factory. Oskar Schindler took me very seriously for my statement, and he took me by my arm and put me into the group of 300 people, and that's how I remained with the group of 300.
But Schindler had lost 700 of his Jews. A few days later, they were loaded into cattle trucks at Plushoff Siding for shipment to Mauthausen death camp. On a blazing hot day, they were kept sealed in their wagons. But while Schindler was visiting Goethe, he discovered their fate. He obtained permission to have them fed, and in full view of the commandant, he ordered the trucks to be hosed down with water to cool them. For the journey, the SS guard was bribed to open the wagons at every stop. But his 300 or so survivors still had faith. Although by September, Amalia had shut down and the prisoners transferred to Plushoff. But Schindler's extensive wheeler dealing had borne fruit. Production, now classified as essential to the war effort, was to be moved to the safety of Brinlitz, near his home in Czechoslovakia. He could take with him 1,000 Jewish specialist metal workers.
At that time, they made a list of people that were supposed to stay and the one that were going. So the idea was to keep all the women and the family of women together. Unfortunately, some never made it, men or women for that matter. And the list was made in a very funny way. I think everybody had something to do with it, whether it was Schindler or Mr. Bankier or the Jewish policeman or even the German engineer, the work for Schindler. A little bit of personal vendetta went into it. And this is how it happened, that people that work from the beginning, they gave their best, never made to Brinnitz and never survived.
This is Schindler's list, the list of life for the lucky thousand. But because Schindler had lost 700 of his Jews during the August selection, there was now room for newcomers from Plushoff. In the scramble to get on it, corruption flourished. The prisoner in charge was a Goethe trustee called Marcel Goldberg.
I asked him, "Marcel, would you be so kind and put me on the list?" So the first question what he asked me, "Do you have diamonds? Do you have dollars?" I said, "Marcel, I don't have no diamonds, I have no dollars, but we are very good friends for so many years, from before the war." So he said to me, "I don't want to use the vulgar words, but he said, you will die here, you will not go no place. Without the diamonds, without this, these were diamonds, but he was taking not for anybody else, only for himself. This was his personal business."
On this list, I saw my name, Pintura Moses, my date of birth, and as Beruf, it's written down, a metal sheet worker. I give you my word. I never put it down. I was never a metal worker. As you heard from my experience that I went to camp being a barackenbau builder, then later I worked in the kitchen. If I would be some kind of a fanatic, or it would be years back, I would say that an angel flew down, marked down my name.
Helena Hirsch, Armin Goethe's maid, secretly offered Schindler 4,000 zlotys to get on the list. He took the money and obtained her release in a most unconventional way.
Schindler został z getta i zaczęli grać w karty. Nie wiem, nie znam tej gry tam, ale dość na tym, że Schindler powiedział, kto wygra, ten dostaje, toż było wtedy, na tę listę mnie trzeba było wziąć, a on się jeszcze wszystko nie zgadzał. Nie chciał pozwolić, żeby mnie wziąć na listę. To on mówi, kto wygra, ten dostaje tą...
Julius Madrich, another slave labor factory owner in Plushoff, who wanted to get some of his prisoners to Brinlitz with Schindler, who agreed to take 60 workers.
When Madrich came one day, he says he can send some people to bring it to Schindler. And if we want to go with our families, he's going to take care of this, which he did. And I was one of the luckies. My wife and he, we wind up in Brindis.
What happened, as far as you know, to the majority of workers who worked for Madrić who didn't take this option to go to Brindis?
They went to different camps. Let's say some went to Dachau, some went to Mauthausen. Some survived, some no, like another camp.
Eventually, 1,100 men, women and children, all supposedly essential munition workers, were crammed onto the list for Brindis. On October the 15th, 1944, the 800 males left Plaszów by cattle truck. But instead of arriving at Schindler's factory to the southwest, the next day they were unloaded at Gross Rosen concentration camp.
Oh, Gross Rosen was really a nightmare. When we arrived at first, they opened the doors of the cattle cars. When we came out, they had the kapos standing with gloves on their hands. They looked very elegant. And they herded us all to one assembly place, which they called Appelplatz. On that assembly place, the first thing they did, they asked us all to disrobe. And this was in October, was quite cold. We all disrobed, and the next thing, they ran us into a shower. We were very apprehensive as far as the shower went. We weren't sure whether we are going to get gas or water. When the water came out, it was a great relief. They kept us all, a few hundred people, in a place which accommodated maybe 30 or 40 people. So what we did, we slept on the floor with our spread eagle legs, and we fitted one into another. This was the only way that they could fit us all into the barrack. And this is how we slept the first night. And this is how we slept the next night. On the third day, I think, the angel arrived. Oskar Schindler came. And as soon as we have seen Schindler, it was like the gates of heaven opened up for us. At that moment, everybody felt safe. If Schindler is here, then nothing will happen to us. And sure enough, a couple of days later, we were transported to Brindis.
Accounts differ as to the exact circumstances of the men's release, whether Schindler was there or not. But 2 days after the men had reached the safety of Brindis, his 300 women also left Plaszów for the new camp. After 12 hours, they had only traveled 40 miles to the gates of Auschwitz.
I remember arriving to Auschwitz at night, and they opened the door from the train, and they said, everybody out. So everybody got out. And we marched in silence, and right away I noticed the chimneys with fire coming out of them, and I didn't say anything, I just motion to my sister-in-law, to my husband's sister, and showed her the chimneys. And they brought us closer and closer to the area where the chimneys were, to some barracks, I don't know exactly what it was, and they told us to get undressed completely, to put our belongings on one side, and to enter the room for a shower. And we stayed there, and we stayed there, and there was no shower, really. And because it took such a long time, the people that worked there, the Jewish people, were sure that the next morning they will really finish us off. They will put us to the gas chambers and burn us.
You know, the sky was all red around us. The smell was kind of different, you know, but we still didn't believe that those things were going on. You know, even when we were told by the Slovak women who were in Auschwitz from the very beginning, that means since 1940 or something, and they were telling us, you're not going to survive, when we ask if we could keep this of our possession or that, why are you worried about it? You're not going to live another day. And so we weren't sure what's going to happen afterwards. But still, we hoped that everything would be all right. You know, that's the optimist, the perennial optimism of the Jews, I suppose.
The next day when they put us outside, Dr. Mengele came over to review the parade. And I remember people referring to him as Angel of Death. And we went through the first selection in Auschwitz. He used to ask women that were younger than myself today, how old are you, grandma? Or children that were in the group, what's your age? And then, of course, they took the old people on one side, and the rest of us were pushed to the good side. And they took us to Birkenau, which was one part of Auschwitz, and we stayed there for 3 weeks. And through those 3 weeks, I think I must have been at least three times